Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Martin Luther King Day holiday has grown into an opportunity for schools to get students involved in community service. Contributor Larry Nagengast visited one school to get a firsthand look at how their students are reaching out to those in need around them. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our latest arts playlist tells us about a new independent movie that will be shooting in and around the First State this year. And we bring you the latest episode of the A Matter of Facts podcast and a conversation about the battle over the removal of Confederate monuments around the country. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Monday was Martin Luther King Day, and schools across the state were closed for the holiday. But that doesn't mean kids stayed home and relaxed. In recent years, many schools and organizations have used the King Day holiday as a day of service, emphasizing the importance of giving back to your community. And that was certainly true earlier this week in the First State. One school doing so was Tower Hill, and contributor Larry Nagengast visited there to get a feel for their efforts and the impact. His piece on Tower Hill's Day of Service is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to chat about what he found there.
Well, let's start with how Tower Hill began its King Day community service efforts and how they've grown over the years.
Okay, this program at Tower Hill began in 2012. Chris Morrow was Tower Hill's Director of Service Learning at the time, and she recognized the importance of honoring Dr. King's legacy through participation in community service activities. Scheduling the event on a holiday would serve two purposes. It would make the students realize that they were part of a larger national effort, and it also made it possible for parents and siblings of those students to participate.
And it is a school-wide effort, right? This is a full school effort.
Yes, absolutely. Everyone from preschoolers right up through 12th graders could participate, and there were activities that were suitable for every age group. The older students would take the lead in showing the younger ones what to do on the various projects, and the youngest participants could do things as basic as coloring placemats, making cards, things like that. Many parents turned out too, as well as a lot of teachers and staff members, so there was this strong community feel all around the building. People got to collaborate and to see each other in something other than a classroom environment.
Let's talk about some of the specific projects. One of them involved making blankets. Tell us a little bit about what that entailed and what the goal was.
Well, one of the neat things about Monday's activities at Tower Hill, and there were other schools that hosted similar events, is how the schools established partnerships with nonprofits in the area. The blanket making project is a really good example. At Tower Hill, I learned about a program that's called Fleece for Keeps, which is started by a Brandywine 100 woman named Sue Day. As she explained to me, 7 years ago, she was volunteering as a mentor at Mount Pleasant Elementary School, and she was paired with a little boy who was in foster care. He had been moved from home to home, and he had very little in the way of possessions of his own. So one day, she offered him a blanket, and he looked up at her, and he asked, "Do I get to keep it?" Well, from that encounter, Sue Day decided that every child in foster care really ought to have a blanket of his or her own. And so she found a way to make them that required no sewing, and then she began finding volunteers. Fleece for Keeps now operates in 4 states and has already distributed more than 5,000 blankets. The Tower Hill volunteers made 50 blankets on Monday, and students at Ursuline Academy and Wilmington Friends School have also made smaller amounts in the past week.
Pretty cool project, and I guess it's also not surprising that a school-based service effort would also involve reading in some way. What was Tower Hill doing, and what need was that particular piece of the service they're trying to address?
Okay, well, again, this one is a really neat little project, too, because it was the idea of a Tower Hill student. Eighth grader Chloe Sachs has created a project that's called Books for the Better. She's one of those kids who has lots of books at home, many of them from summer reading assignments, that she's never going to read again. But the books were in good condition, and surely somebody would want to read them. She found her audience, teachers, mostly at charter schools, who want to build up the libraries in their own classrooms. And then she asked her friends and classmates to donate their unwanted books. So on Monday, students and teachers alike gathered in Tower Hill's library to sort the donated books and stack them up either by grade level or age level. Chloe's next step is to get the books distributed to the teachers who asked for them. Some teachers want books every month, others at the start of each semester. Whatever they ask for, Chloe is trying to meet their needs. And I have to say, it's definitely inspiring to see an eighth grader identify a need like this and then figure out a way to solve the problem.
That is pretty impressive. There was one other outreach project you noted in your piece. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I guess you're talking about the flower pots. Really a pretty interesting operation set up on one of the tables in the corner of the cafeteria. The kids set it up in sort of an assembly line. They take a pot of soil, maybe 1 inch square, briefly soak it in water, then drop it into a cardboard-based biodegradable pot. It's about the size of a real small terracotta flower pot. On top of that, they dropped in a cutout that's shaped like a flower, and actually inside this cutout, there are seeds embedded. So now once you put it all together, they drop it into a pint-sized gift box, and it's real easy to make, and it's something cheerful that's now destined to find a place on the windowsills of clients of the Lutheran Community Services Organization.
There's also a learning component to the day. How did that work?
Well, again, there's several pieces here organized by a couple of parent groups at the school. One, they had a Jeopardy-style game with questions and answers based on the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. And they had a video screen. You tap on the screen or pick a question, and one of the adults would give the answer, and then you've got to guess the question. That's how Jeopardy works. And then there was also this matching game. There were two sets of cards laid out on a table. One set had portraits of the names of with the name and of the important figures in African American history. The other set of cards had a biographical sketch. The goal for the students was to match the face on the card with the card that had the individual's biography. Make three matches and you qualify to get a prize at the end of the day.
And while the focus of their efforts at Tower Hill is on the King Day holiday itself, your story indicates this is not limited to just the holiday. Tell us a little bit of what they do beyond the holiday.
Last year, Tower Hill started something that they call Tower Term, which is a year-end, one-week project-based learning exercise. It goes into topics that normally aren't covered in the classroom. This year, the school decided to offer Tower Term at the end of each semester, so twice a year rather than once. And for the school's sophomores, their project options involve community service work at a selection of 10 different organizations, agencies like Habitat for Humanity, the Ronald McDonald House, Head Start programs, Tri-State Bird and Rescue, Faithful Friends Animal Society. So from Tuesday through Friday this week, sophomores have been volunteering at agencies like these and giving back to the community. Now, it's worth noting that Bessie Spears, who was hired 3.5 years ago as head of Tower Hill, has made community service a big priority there. Now, the longtime people associated with the school say that it does have a service tradition that dates back to its founding 100 years ago, but there's still a really stark contrast between the low-income areas of Wilmington's east side and west center city and the well-manicured campus of Tower Hill on the far western side of town, not far from where some of the most prominent members of the DuPont family lived a century ago and actually founded the school. And Spears has been dedicated to making Tower Hill more a part of the city, and the sophomore class's week of community service is one more example of that.
And certainly Tower Hill is not the only school that does this type of service day. You noted that earlier. You looked around and found some others. Who else is using the King Day holiday to celebrate service?
Well, again, I didn't do a complete survey, and there were a couple of events on Monday that were canceled due to the freezing temperatures. But here are a couple of examples that I can give you. On Monday, Ursuline Academy did have a program much like the one at Tower Hill. Sixth through eighth graders at Tatnall School had their own service day late last week, where they actually went out and worked at different agencies in the greater Wilmington area. And fifth grade preschoolers through fifth grade at Wilmington Friends also had a program of their own. Salesianum School, which organizes a variety of community service programs throughout the year, sent three groups of 10 students each on week-long trips to learn about and assist Native American and immigrant and refugee populations in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The group that went to El Paso actually participated in a prayer service with Mexican citizens on the other side of the border fence on the edge of the city. Peace marches, prayer breakfasts, speeches by politicians, all of these things have become regular features of Martin Luther King Day. But to me, at least, seeing young people making positive contributions to society comes a lot closer to demonstrating the real meaning of Dr. King's legacy.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightengast for his time this week. His stories on Tower Hill's King Day holiday, Day of Service, and other similar efforts around the state are available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Arts Playlist is next on The Green, with more on an independent movie shooting in the region this year. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A new indie thriller movie starts filming in Ocean City, Maryland soon. It's called To Avenge, and according to Philadelphia-based writer, producer, and photographer Nick Belial, filming later this year will take the production to Lewis and Slaughter Beach, as well as Wilmington, Pennsylvania, and Cape May, New Jersey. Belial says To Avenge is about a young woman who is sexually assaulted while visiting her friends in Ocean City, and a complete stranger steps in to help avenge what happened to her. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently sat down and spoke with Belial about his movie and also learned he's looking for extras to help out.
Why To Avenge? How did you come up with the title of this new film?
It actually is the third title that we worked with, all very similar, but it actually plays into the music soundtrack that will be part of the film, and it's very integral to what the story's about. It goes back to the idea of the difference between revenge, when somebody gets vengeance for themselves for something that happens to them, or avenge, when somebody else goes out to seek justice for something bad that happened or for a perceived wrong. So that's what's happening in our story, is that a bad, tragic thing happens to a young college-age woman, and then a stranger that's unknown to her basically takes it on herself to go out and avenge what's happened to her.
Nick, why Ocean City? How did you come up with Ocean City as the backdrop for this?
I've actually been going to Ocean City for more than 40 years, and I absolutely love it there. There's just something electric in the air when you're on the boardwalk, and I love being close to the ocean. I feel most at home when I'm in that area. So for me, it was just a natural, the boardwalk being there, the excitement of the boardwalk, and that's where our very first scene in the movie takes place, at the boardwalk. And unfortunately, that's where these young men that end up assaulting our main character, Vera, that's where they first encounter her, and she attracts basically their unwanted attention, and they end up following her home and assaulting.
All right, so here's what everybody wants to know. Who's going to star in To Avenge?
Well, I, as an indie filmmaker, I will tell you that, and this is my first outing as director, I've worked on a lot of films, but this is the first time where I actually wrote the story, will be helping to produce it, and will be directing this. It's extremely rare, from what I understand, for a first-time director, and in many cases, even directors that have been at it for years, to be able to attract quality, you know, like cast. Let's put this: cast members that have a known name. A lot of times, you get local actors, and they're fantastic. But to get the bigger name stars, a lot of times you have to be that Hollywood-type personality that has a lot of successes under your belt. What I attribute the success so far of us having a great cast for To Avenge is the script. It's not me. It's not that I have a long history in film. It is this script. Everyone who reads this script and understands just the powerful nature of a crime like this happening to a young woman and everything that unfolds after that. And to see the strength in her and the resilience in her, it just seems that everyone that reads this script is drawn to it. So I've been very lucky that the people that I've approached to ask to be in the film, I've got some great talent. So, for example, Erica Eleniak, a lot of people would know her as a kid. She was in the movie E.T., The Extraterrestrial, Steven Spielberg, and she plays a little girl in the film that has her first on-screen kiss with the little boy that discovers E.T. Later in life, you might know her from a Steven Seagal film that she did that was very popular, and also Baywatch. She was known for being in the original cast of Baywatch. So we were very lucky to get Erica, and another actor that we feel extremely lucky to be working with, Zach Galligan. Everyone knows him from Gremlins and Gremlins 2, and they're talking about doing a reboot of Gremlins. And we're very lucky to have Zach on board. We also have Kelly Maroney. Kelly was really the first big-name actress that expressed interest in the film. When she first heard about the film, the plot, the storyline, and read the script, she literally fell in love with her character. She plays Abigail Danvers, and that's the wife of this very powerful and ruthless billionaire that's in the film. And she wrote me a note saying, I absolutely love Abigail. Yes, I want to play her. And that really gave me the confidence to move forward and start asking other stars, because I had watched Kelly as a kid when I was back in high school. She was in like classic films like Night of the Comet and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. So the fact that I was just talking to her was really exciting, but the fact that she wanted to be in my film because she loved the script was mind-blowing. So again, very lucky to have somebody like Kelly Maroney in our film. We have Bernard Robichaud. He's known for Trailer Park Boys and a movie called Sea Change. Just a great actor, and he really fits the bill just looks-wise and the power of his acting, his presence on screen. He's going to be great in the role of that ruthless billionaire. He plays Clayton Danvers. Bernard Robichaud plays Clayton Danvers, the ruthless billionaire, who basically, when he finds out that his sons are being charged with this crime that they committed, he does whatever it takes to clear the family name and to get his kids out of trouble. So he just is perfect in that role. He's the nicest guy. Very, very proud to have him on board. And we're just really blessed with a good cast. I could go on. We have Brooke Lewis. And our two main characters are up and coming. That's Taylor Hay, who plays our main character, Vera Castor. And then we have Hannah Kleeman, who will be playing the very enigmatic, mysterious Tarna, the one who basically goes on the vengeance hunt.
All right, we're talking to Nick Belial. He is from the Philadelphia area. He's a writer, he's a producer, he's a photographer. He's writing and producing right now a new film to be filmed in Ocean City starting next fall. It's called To Avenge. It's about a young woman named Vera who was sexually assaulted while visiting her friend in Ocean City. And when her attackers are arrested, the media kind of goes into a frenzy because two of the men are brothers of a billionaire family. Coercion and blackmail behind the scenes lead to the defense attorney dropping the charges. Sounds like a great movie, Nick. Besides Ocean City, although the bulk of the filming will take place in Ocean City, Maryland, you're also going to be filming in Pennsylvania, Cape May, New Jersey, as well as a couple of beaches in Delaware, Lewis and Slaughter Beach. Are you familiar with those two beaches in Delaware as well as the beach in Ocean City?
Oh, absolutely. I'm newly familiar with Slaughter Beach. I was introduced to that area for the first time a couple of years ago, working on the set of a film called Delaware Shore, directed by Raghav Perry. And there's a natural, I guess you would call it a phenomenon. At least I was never familiar with it before, that happens with the tides there. And this beautiful, quiet little beach where every year the horseshoe crabs migrate and come up onto the beach. But there's this really neat thing that happens with the tides there. And while I was working there and saw that, I thought this would be a great place for a key scene, a crucial scene that's in my film. So we're going to be filming one scene. As I said, it's a very crucial key scene to the film, right on Slaughter Beach, right in the same location where we shot Delaware Shore. And then as far as Lewis, we're not actually shooting on the beaches of Lewis as much as we'll be heading to the Cape May Lewis Ferry. Our main character takes a ferry ride after her assault. It's some months later. And she, like me, there's a little bit of me in Vera. She loves the water. She's drawn to the sea. So she basically, just to clear her mind, takes a ride from her home down to the beach, gets on the ferry, and goes over to Cape May. Again, more or less just to take that ride, just to be out on the water. And it's a beautiful scenery there with the lighthouse in the distance. So, yeah, I'm very much familiar with the area of Rehoboth, Lewis, and Slaughter Beach. I'm excited to return to Slaughter Beach as well.
Nick, talk briefly about your background. What is your background? How did you get interested in filmmaking?
Well, I actually got my start as a staff photographer on my high school's yearbook. And I really enjoyed doing that, just like capturing candid portraits of people. And unfortunately, I went to a private school, very nice school, but they placed very little value on the arts. That kind of thing was never discussed, strictly academics. So it never really occurred to me. Nobody ever guided me or any of my classmates into anything that might have been connected with the arts. So my career took a different direction. I was good at science and math, and I pretty much looked at my future through that spectrum. So I ended up in the healthcare industry, and I loved that. I loved helping make a difference in people's lives. But some years ago, after doing that for a while, I realized that something was missing. The artistic side of my life, it just wasn't there. So around that time, a friend of mine that was looking to break into acting and modeling contacted me and asked if I could shoot her, to help her build up some pictures for her portfolio. And it all just snowballed from there. It just took off. She told friends, and before I knew it, I was shooting weddings, headshots for actors, and again, helping models build their professional portfolios.
A very diverse background you have. Hey, you, I heard somewhere that you're looking for extras to star in To Avenge. How can people partake in that?
Absolutely, Kelly. Well, what I would ask anyone that's interested, rather than just someone say, hey, I'd like to be an extra in any film, I'm really looking for the extras and actors for this film that feel a connection to our story, what we're putting out there. So I'm asking anybody who would hear about this to first research the film. Look us up, Google us, or use a search engine of your choice. Get out there and check out our IMDb page, our website. Read about the story, read about the characters and our great cast, and then if it's something that speaks to you and the story is something that you would like to be a part of, that's the kind of person that we're looking for to put in our film. So then a great way to get in touch with us would be through our website, which is twoavenge.com. And after you've done that research, if you're interested, there's a place at the bottom of the page. It says, for more information, you can contact us here. And just go on and give us basic information. Give us your full name, your age. If you can, attach a single picture, a headshot, just to show us who you are and what you look like. And just, let us know what your connection is with the area. If you're an Ocean City resident or a Salisbury resident, or if you live in Fenwick Island or Rehoboth or Wilmington, Delaware, just let us know that you're from this general area and what your interest is in being in the film as an extra, as a background extra on the boardwalk scene, or a courthouse reporter scene, or one of Vera's coworkers. And we get a lot of people interested. and there's a little bit of a process to go through. But once we have your information, we'll work on picking the right people for the parts. And it's just a fun experience for background extras that I've talked to. They get to be on set. They get to see what the filmmaking magic is all about.
Nick, you plan to start filming To Avenge in Ocean City next September. How quickly do you think you'll turn things around, and how soon will it be in theaters?
Well, the first part of that is we're looking at total filming taking 5 weeks. And I would say almost all the days, but except for maybe five or six, will be shot in the Ocean City, Lewis, Slaughter Beach area. There will be some scenes shot up in Wilmington and some possibly in suburban Philadelphia, but about 5 weeks for actual production. The second part, when you're asking about when will it be in theaters, that is something that I can't answer at this point. It's these things, they take time. A lot of people, when they go to a movie, they don't realize that the actors that you're watching possibly film those scenes a year and a half, 2 years, and in some cases even more years, 4 or 5 years ago.
That's this week's Arts Playlist. Thanks to our Kelly Steele and Nick Belial, the man behind the movie To Avenge, which will be filming in Delaware and the surrounding region this year. And stay with us. The Green continues in just a moment with the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast from Delaware Humanities. But first, a look at the latest local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Pern. Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has created a podcast, A Matter of Facts, to delve into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of its mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. Delaware Public Media is proud to help produce this podcast, and we also thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And this week on The Green, we bring you the latest episode of A Matter of Facts. Thanks for joining us again on the A Matter of Facts podcast. I'm Tom Byrne, sitting in for Nancy Karavjanian. In recent years, a very contentious battle has been waged over public symbols of the Confederacy, specifically monuments, statues, and memorials throughout the South. Many have called for their removal, saying they are racist symbols of the country's legacy of slavery. The other side argues they should remain because of their significance in recounting our country's history and honoring the heritage of the South and those who fought for the Confederacy. The debate intensified in 2015 after 9 African Americans were killed in a Charleston, South Carolina church shooting by a white man who said he sought to start a race war. And again in 2017 after a white nationalist march to protest the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville, Virginia, saw a counter-protester killed amid violent clashes between demonstrators. And while it has not been in the national headlines as much recently, this is an ongoing debate. Earlier this month, a judge in Alabama ruled against that state's 2017 law prohibiting the removal of historical monuments that have been placed for more than 40 years. The judge argued the law violated the rights of citizens opposed to Confederate monuments and, quote, placed a thumb on the scale for a pro-Confederacy message, unquote. And the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, removed the base of its controversial Silent Sam monument recently, the main portion of which was toppled by protesters last year. To delve more into this topic and where it stands now and to gain some more historical perspective and context, we welcome Dr. Caroline Janey, director of the John Now Center for Civil War History at the University of Virginia. She's the author of Burying the Dead, But Not the Past, Ladies Memorial Associations and the Lost Cause, and Remembering the Civil War, Reunion and the Limits of Reconciliation. Caroline Janey, thank you so much for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So the first thing I want to hit on is that while for some this may seem like a somewhat contemporary issue born out of the flashpoint events I mentioned just a moment ago, it's not, is it?
It's not. The debates over how the Civil War should or should not be remembered have been there as long as since the Civil War itself, since the guns stopped firing in the spring of 1865. There have been debates among various groups, Union and Confederates, white and black, men and women, over who gets to control the story that we tell ourselves about the war.
So let's head back in time. Can you tell us a little bit about how the initial monuments built in the era shortly after the Civil War were received and how they reflect how the war was remembered at that time?
Sure. So the very first monuments that went up, there were a handful of monuments that went up during the war itself. Those were primarily in cemeteries, so they were memorial in nature, Union soldiers in particular. But the first monuments that we can talk about on battlefields, for example, happened at Manassas or Bull Run in the summer of 1865. Keep in mind that there's a great deal of irony that the first two monuments that went up, they were sandstone monuments put up by Union soldiers in honor of their brethren, their comrades who had died during both the First and Second Battle of Manassas. Battles, and the irony comes in that those were both Confederate victories on the battlefield. But this was in Virginia, and they were worried about how these monuments might be received. And so there was a great deal of debate about whether former Confederates would vandalize these monuments. So those were some of the first Union monuments. In the years, and more importantly, in the decades that followed, by the 1870s, and especially the 1880s, and it's really the 1880s, we start to see an uptick of Union monuments in places like courthouse lawns, or by the late 1880s, Gettysburg in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Confederate monuments start primarily in cemeteries. The earliest ones are, one of the earliest was a pyramid that's in Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, Virginia. And those monuments tended to be more of a mourning nature, as would be fitting in a cemetery. We don't find the Confederate statues, as we think about courthouse lawns mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, until the very end of the century. It's really 1890s that we start to see monuments, Confederate monuments, that is, move out of the cemeteries into more public spaces.
As we move forward in time, a fair amount has been written in the media about the comprehensive study of Confederate statues and monuments published by the Southern Poverty Law Center in 2016. And it showed spikes in construction of them twice during the 20th century in the early 1900s and then again in the 1950s and 60s, which they point out were times of heightened civil rights tension. Is it fair to directly connect those spikes in monuments to an effort to disenfranchise African Americans or promote white supremacy or any of those kind of narratives we've seen?
Yes and no. One of the wonderful things, now this is a bit of an aside, but one of the wonderful things about studying history are the many complexities and contradictions and ironies. And this is a case in point. So the answer to your question is yes, they are related, and no, they're not related. If we look at those two peaks of Confederate monument building, the other two things that we have to keep in mind, the first peak that happens around 1911 through the early 1920s was the semicentennial, the 50th anniversary
mm-hmm.
of the Civil War. And so there was a lot of activity surrounding that, whether we think about blue-gray reunions that happened at places like Gettysburg. That high point is both a reflection of the 50th anniversary. It's also a point in which the Civil War, the generation, both Union and Confederate, it's not unlike what happened several years ago when World War II monuments were going up
mm-hmm.
throughout the country. As that generation started to pass away, their children and grandchildren made a concerted effort to memorialize them. It was also in response, Confederate monuments were also in response to the growing number of Union monuments as well. So those Confederate monuments that go up, they're going up at the same time, for example, as the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and the Grant Memorial in front of Congress, so 1922. So in some ways, they're not connected at all to whether it's the birth of the Niagara Movement in 1909 and the NAACP, and to the atrocities, the horrible things that were going on with segregation, disfranchisement, lynchings, all of those other things that are going on. Now, did the Confederate monuments serve to bolster and remind African Americans of their place in society? Absolutely. But I'm not convinced that that was the number one reason that they go up when they went up, especially in the teens and early 20s.
But perhaps maybe more so in the 50s and 60s?
More so in the 50s and 60s, yes. Now, again, that the 1960s marks the centennial.
Right.
I do think there is a clearer connection in the 50s and 60s. And especially the key is not just looking at the monuments themselves, but looking at the language of the memorial speeches, dedications, things mm-hmm. of that nature that give us some context. And that absolutely, the Silent Sam speech at UNC, mm-hmm. that surely is indicative of racial attitudes, white supremacist attitudes, and how those were built into that monument. I'm not denying that those aspects weren't there, but we see it more and more as we move into the 20th century. We see it more and more, even in the 30s and 40s, the rhetoric is much more stringently about, for example, the federal government imposing its will on the South mm-hmm. and resisting that intrusion, if you will, of the federal government in the same way that Confederates had tried to resist the national government telling them what to do. So there are more parallels in the 1950s and 60s than in that early 20th century period.
Is there any indication how African Americans felt about these monuments when they went up? And does that say anything about how we should view them or their impact?
Oh, absolutely. So to response, one of the best examples of responses is a little bit earlier. It's the Lee Monument that goes up in Richmond on Monument Avenue in 1890. Mm-hmm. And the African American newspaper in Richmond, the Richmond Planet, John Mitchell, African-American editor. He was also a member of the Richmond City Council. He's pretty plain-spoken about what he thought the Lee Monument meant to African-Americans, and it was a reminder of their inferior status, of their place, and he did not believe that taxpayer money and the statue itself was funded in a lot of different ways from private donations, but the fact that the city was, in fact, allowing this plot of land, that it was a citywide celebration. He condemned and saw this as a symbol of white power, if not necessarily, if that wasn't the reason that people initially started raising money to put the monument up, it certainly has that message built into it.
We are speaking with Caroline Janey, director of the John Now Center for Civil War History at the University of Virginia, about Confederate monuments and the battle over their removal. I wanted to ask you, as much as we attempt to kind of add this context and understanding you're bringing us, you know, about these monuments and why they were built, there is no escaping, obviously, how many view them now in the context of the current political climate. Do you see that as the reason why this has become such a contentious debate, this effort to try to reconcile the history with the here and now?
Absolutely. And it's also a reflection of the way in which memory, whether we're talking about Civil War memorialization or any other aspect of our past that we choose to commemorate and memorialize rather than simply interrogate and understand, there's a natural pattern to that. So the efforts of people to put up monuments or to create museums in the 19th century were a product of their time, a product of the context, the social, political, economic context in which they lived. And the same is true now. The efforts to take down monuments is very much, you know, situated within the context of Black Lives Matter and other social, political movements that are going on. So in some ways, we need to take a long durée view. We need to back up and look at that long trajectory. This is another part of the story. You know, the monuments went up in a particular time and place, and as we see them either come down or see their memory challenged, that absolutely is both a product of and a reflection of contemporary political issues.
A number of ideas have been put forward about what to do with these Confederate monuments. What do you see as the pros and cons to removal versus providing context to them and leaving them where they are, or perhaps moving to an alternate location such as a museum and offering context in that type of venue?
Well, I first and foremost believe that it's up to individual communities to decide that. And I think what's happened in Alabama, we're on the right way, in which the state or a state no longer is going to make decisions for communities. So what those communities decide to do, you know, I think that is the central maybe not answer, but it should be decided at the community level. There's certainly pros and cons to removing monuments. If you remove them from the place where they exist, whether that's just, for example, a courthouse lawn, mm-hmm. or in the case of UNC, you know, the middle of campus, a very prominent place on campus, then on one hand, you've removed that symbol of many different things, and it's been a symbol of different things over time. We know, for example, that Silent Sam was a place in which white supremacists had rallied for many years. That's not something that's new as of 2015, 2017. Mm-hmm. So you're removing that place, that symbol for such groups. But at the same time, and it's not that you're losing history. I don't mean to, I know in other venues I've suggested that we're removing history. We're not removing history of the Confederates. What we're removing is the story of people who tried to control the narrative. And so we have to be conscious of what that does when we take that part of the story out. We need to make sure that we are relaying the contentious nature of all of this. If you put a monument in a museum, especially a monument, a big towering equestrian monument, doesn't quite have the same impact for good and bad, that it has on a city street, for example. So, again, though, I think, you know, different communities have found different ways of offering interpretive, great new ways of interpreting the past. So in Baltimore, where one of the Taney memorials, he's taken down and two chairs are put up, mm-hmm. and that's symbolic in its own right. There's no one answer.
Delaware's only Confederate monument is in the southern part of the state, in the town of Georgetown. It was installed in 2007 by a group of descendants of Confederate veterans on the property of the Marvell Carriage Museum. The museum is a private, nonprofit facility run by the Georgetown Historical Society. So my question based on that is, how different a discussion is this when we're talking about something like this that's on a private property, private facility, compared to a public property like a university or, as you said, a courthouse or something like that?
That makes all the difference in the world. I mean, if it's on someone's private property, then he or she or that corporation, whatever the case may be, has the right to do so. We might not like it, but that's not the same as a public university or a courthouse square that belongs to all of us. So, I mean, I know some of the surrounding Antietam, for example, a monument to Lee went up not so many years ago, but it's on private property. So there's nothing that the Park Service can do about that. So it's not unlike the question of the Confederate battle flag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, private individuals, as offensive as we may find it, along Interstate 4 or 29 South in Virginia, flying big Confederate flags, if that's on private property, then that's, you know, freedom of speech, that's one thing. That's not the case when it's flying above or adjacent to a state house, the South Carolina State House, or whatever the case may be.
We've also heard the slippery slope argument, right? How far should this go? Should building and street names be changed, et cetera? And if you do this, what might be next beyond Confederate symbols to be removed, and what does that mean for detailing our history? What do you feel about that argument that some people make when trying to defend the Confederate monuments?
Well, you know, again, that we're a product of the times in which we live, and if people now think that if a given community, whether that's a school, decides that it's time to change its name, time to change its mascot, or a city decides that there's a street that needs to be changed, if that's how the people there feel and that's how they see, as they think about what that name or symbol represents to them, then that absolutely should be something that happens. So the slippery slope argument, you know, can be made about so many things.
Right.
An easy way out of really engaging in a topic.
I'm curious, are there any other cultural comparisons we can draw upon when we look at this debate to see what other countries may have done in similar situations and how their decisions wind up playing out?
Well, you know, the reference is usually made to Nazi Germany. I don't think those comparisons fit quite as easily or as well as we might like them to where the Confederacy is concerned. So I think it's not that we should be looking to other countries or other places. We should be listening to people here and trying to figure out what communities want and who has a voice in that. That's the big difference if we look at, say, the 1920s. Who got to decide where any monument went up, whether that monument was to Roger Taney or to a Confederate soldier? What people in the community were involved? Who had a voice and who did not? And to the degree that we can have a more collective conversation, that's the key today, to be representative of what we as a society in 2019 think is appropriate and worth commemorating. And that's the difference. You know, we can, that's what memorialization is, that understanding history, interpreting history, reading about, studying, writing about history doesn't mean that we either necessarily condone or condemn the past. But monuments are different because they are meant to commemorate. They're meant to hold up a certain set of values and ideals. And so it has to be reflective of what a group of people, a society today, thinks is worth celebrating. And it's that celebratory nature that we need to keep in mind.
And we like to end our podcast by asking each of our guests the same question, and that is, where do you get your news? What are your favorite news sources?
News in terms of national news, international news, what are you thinking of?
Honestly, either one. You can speak to all kind of general news or also in terms of, if you want to speak specifically to kind of your venue of study.
Well, those are different arenas for me. I am somebody who gets news from a variety of fashions, both new and old. I still listen to NPR. I watch network news and CNN on TV, but I still turn to The Times and Washington Post. And I also am a firm believer in knowing what's going on in my local community. So the local Charlottesville newspaper and the University of Virginia Cavalier Daily are places that I go to.
Dr. Caroline Janey, director of the John Now Center for Civil War History at the University of Virginia, thank you so much for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.